You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail.
The sunrise, and at 5 a.m. you get on the bus. The people look so resigned to the daily grind, and you swear it'll never be you. You said that you were new in town.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Intersections, presented by CITR's Intersectionality Collective. We're here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel of collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, sexuality, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
The city living is ugly.
Listeners, this is Randy from Intersections. As many of you may know, this week is Fund Drive here at CITR, the one time each year where we ask for your support to help us keep local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. For me, CITR and Intersections has been a huge part of my life. I've been a member of this collective for the past 3 years, and I'm super excited to be ending my university career as a part of this collective. I really am proud of the work that we've done this year and in the years before. So if you're in a position to donate, please contribute. You can visit citr.ca/donate to donate. Thank you so much. And for this episode, we're going to be talking about our ins and outs for 2023. Don't worry, it won't be too serious. It'll be a lot of fun. We hope you enjoy listening, and also look out for our personal testimonies from different collective members. You can visit citr.ca/donate to contribute to our show. Just make sure that you choose Intersections from the drop-down menu.
Hello, all listeners, and welcome to our Fund Drive 2023 episode. We're going to start kicking it off with my what's out for 2023. And starting it a little controversially, we're going to be starting it with my out for the year, which is Colleen Hoover, and specifically her It Ends With Us book. I'm not sure if any of my other fellow participants have read this book, but I have. I went into it. It was my second Colleen Hoover book. The first book I read by her was Verity, which was a little bit weird for my tastes, but didn't quite stir up the anger that I felt when I read It Ends With Us. For those who don't know, It Ends With Us is, spoiler alert, a book about a woman getting out of the cycle of domestic abuse. However, there is quite a bit of controversy with the author and how she has handled it. So the first thing that I was touching on is the idea of authors capitalizing off of these very sensitive topics. For those who don't know, Colleen Hoover recently also tried to release a coloring book based off of It Ends With Us, which again is a book about domestic abuse and escaping generational cycles of domestic abuse. And that did not go over well online. The coloring book ended up being canceled. However, it still brings up the question for me of how far are authors actually allowed to capitalize on these sensitive topics before we kind of say that it's too far and it takes away from the moral of the book, which is that it's a very sensitive topic. It impacted a lot of people deeply. However, it's become a commodity that Colleen Hoover is herself benefiting from. My second issue with Colleen Hoover and It Ends With Us is the recent casting of Blake Lively in the movie adaptation. This is a completely personal what's out with her. It's no real beef with the author, but just sort of in general. And that's that Lily Bloom, the main character that Blake Lively is playing, is supposed to be about 22 years old. And I know that there is a serious trend of people playing like characters much younger than them, But as amazing as I think that Blake Lively looks, I just simply can't agree that she is supposed to play this very naive looking 22-year-old, and we could have just found instead a natural redhead, because Lily Bloom is, of course, a redhead, because she also has a flower shop. Lots of issues with this book. But I also just don't think that actors need to be playing characters that are 20 years younger than them when there are lots of 22, 23, even 25-year-olds in the industry who are looking for a job and would love to be in a big movie adaptation. And my final kind of issue with Colleen Hoover is the general controversy around her and the topics that she writes about, as well as her personal life that's kind of come to be an influencing factor. Colleen Hoover, for those who are not as absorbed with book talk and the general book world drama as I am, received a message from a young girl talking about how Colleen Hoover's son allegedly had sexually assaulted someone, and she deleted the message, ignored it, never addressed it on any sort of social media platforms, and moved on. Which is another controversy, because so many of her books touch on these sensitive topics like domestic abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual violence, which really brings up the question of how much do we separate art from the author for me, and are we still justifying authors who ignore these topics in real life but touch on them in their book as people who are really deserving to be representing these topics to the general public with a primarily very young readership. So that's kind of my out spiel about Colleen Hoover. If anybody wants to let me know what their thoughts are and if they agree.
I agree. I fully think Colleen Hoover is out in 2022 or 2023. Well, she was out in 2022. And I think all of book talk, at least most of book talk, a lot of the book talk that I'm on anyways, would agree with you. I also think Colleen Hoover is so interesting because I read her books in high school. Like when I was like 15, I read her books about like college students. I have no idea what they're called. But it was such like a weird like fever dream when I got on Book Talk and these like 30-year-old white women were reading her books. And I was like, what is this? Like, why? Like, cause I thought they were bad at 15. Like I was reading them being like, I should not be reading this. Like, and I think that literally contributed so much to like my poor mental health and like not understanding healthy relationships, because like, yeah, her books are like not. Yeah. And I think it's also like a marketing thing, like the way in which like It Ends With Us was marketed. It's marketed as like a straight like romance novel. But everyone I've talked to, like the people that read it, it's like it's a fiction novel. Like it's not to like market as romance is also like misleading, because like what you're saying, it's about a woman like breaking, you know, the domestic violence like cycle. So yeah, I agree. She's out. And I haven't read her since I was 15. So it doesn't affect me at all.
Yeah, this is very much like, again, another personal Colleen Hoover, but I just can't get over to her lack of range in writing. I found that her characters are basically the exact same, which is like always a very naive young woman falling into like this horrible situation where she's like abused physically, mentally, emotionally in some way, shape, or form. And eventually it just gets very exhausting trying to read her. And part of the reason why she's out is that, again, it's marketed like as a romance book. And very similarly, I'm sort of starting to see that the film adaptation, which I think is an awful idea in the first place, is to adapt this book about like witnessing very in-depth domestic violence occur, is probably not a great idea to like bring to the big screen. And touching on what you said about like reading it when you were a younger age too, a lot of people argue on TikTok, especially because I love scrolling through the comments on these things, is that a lot of people are like, oh, it's technically an adult book, but I'm like, you can't really ignore the fact that you have a really young readership who is accessing it. So that wraps up my section for what's out, and we will be moving on to the next what's out in 2023.
Interested in more content like what you just heard? Fascinated with topics concerning social justice and occasional pop culture references? This Fund Drive season, donate to Intersections to help us continue to support local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. From February 2nd to 9th, just select Intersections at the drop-down menu at citr.ca/donate. All prize levels include previous levels. Thanks in advance. Oh, love is the sweetest thing. A smile.
Yeah, so hi, I'm Adeline. And last year when I saw like an out that was considered an out by pop culture, but it seems to like kind of carry over to this year because it's kind of like a more, like a topic that's kind of like more general, like I feel like it's still relevant now. So last year around October 2022, Taylor Swift released like a new video for her single, her new single Anti-Hero. And there was like a controversy about the way that body image was depicted there. So apparently, and I only saw the video recently because before I'd only seen like an article about this whole controversy. And so I was like still kind of thinking about like the way that this phenomenon was portrayed in the articles. So apparently in the scene that was controversial, it features her looking down at a scale that displays the word fat as the weight. And apparently this video is about her going within and facing her shadow side. After she looks down on the scale, her alter ego in the video shakes her head. So it's kind of like a disapproving look. And it's meant to show like struggles with her body image, but several fat activists on social media thought this scene was apparently fat phobic. And so she edited it out afterwards. So the new version doesn't feature the scene with the scale. It just cuts to the alter ego shaking her head at the depicted weight. And so I just wanted to turn it over to the floor. And my question would be, do you think this scene should have been edited out? Does this kind of depiction of body image misrepresent the experiences of people going through eating disorders and other situations? And so I was kind of like, this was kind of turning around in my head over the winter break. So I just thought I'd like to open it for a discussion to everyone. So yeah, go ahead, Ava.
Yeah, I've definitely heard about this controversy. But I've definitely heard about it less from the side that it's misrepresenting the experiences of people with eating disorders and more furthering this connotation that fat is automatically bad. I understand the artistic choice to, I guess, put fat instead of a specific number, because that would have been just as triggering, especially knowing the topic at hand. But I think that in a lot of what I've been hearing from, you know, the community of people who are trying to fight fat phobia, is that we have to get out of this idea that fat is automatically bad and that people who are of a larger weight dislike the word, because there are a lot of people who are very open and happy to identify their body as fat, and they think that that can be a body neutral thing. And I think that with body positivity, I personally prefer going towards body neutrality, which is that instead of fighting to make everybody beautiful and everything is like, this is another sign of beauty, is that we need to like deprioritize beauty in the conversation. And I think that the scene really was showing that fat is still has this label of ugly.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Ava, what you said about like the role that body neutrality plays in this. And I think also the problem with like the scale and the way the scene was shot, like it not only adds to this conversation about like, you know, fat is an automatic bad thing, but it's also Taylor Swift has never been fat. And so like, even though she's received thousands of comments online, I'm sure as like every single famous woman ever has, calling her fat, it's very different. Like the ways in which we talk about like, you know, body image issues and like, you know, the ways we view our body, that's different than like actually facing like societal oppression of being in a fat body. Like being fat is completely different than like seeing yourself as fat or viewing yourself. And so I think that also contributed to it in the minds of, yeah, a lot of people that are, you know, working against the anti-fat bias that we have in society. And I think like that's important to remember also.
Oh yeah, that's an amazing point. And I just wanted to extend on that a little bit, because so rarely do I feel like we talk about how fat phobia really causes like systemic issues in society. And it's not just this matter of individual people struggling with their individual body issues, because like systemic bias in healthcare against people who are fat is so rampant, and their experiences, like their lived experiences of pain, are consistently diminished. And that's just one example of how fat phobia has real effects on people's lives who are legitimately like I don't want to start, you know, saying who's fat, who's not, you know, but like, once again, Taylor Swift is not someone who is experiencing this systemic discrimination, like, due to her body weight. She is in a very public role, and she has faced a lot of, like, public backlash about her body, which is a very unfair thing to experience, but it is not the same experience that people who are fat are having.
Yeah, Ava, I was just kind of gonna reiterate what you were saying, actually, just that, like, as far as I understood it, I haven't seen the video, but it's Taylor Swift on the scale, right? Like, it's herself. Yeah, so it's kind of like her using that term and, like, showing her body first throughout this whole video, and then putting that label specifically of it as fat, and, like, without talking about, like, obviously it's a music video, maybe she can't get into, like, oh, this is my self-perception, whatever, but, like, she's not talking about where this idea is coming from. She's just saying, hey guys, look at my body, I think I'm fat, how do you feel about yourself? And I think that, like, she has such a wide audience, and so many kinds of people are watching this video. It's just, like, very, very harmful. And some of those viewers are, like, super young and, like, might not have thought that way about themselves before.
Yeah, so I think the reason this topic kind of turned around in my brain is, like, a combination of what everyone brought up here. Because when we did our previous Intersections episode on body positivity, going back to that definition, about what body positivity is, and it's about, like, feeling good about your body and the way it looks, and kind of, like, the whole social movement devoted to encouraging, like, an acceptance of diverse body types. And so, like, I'm really glad we had this discussion because it brings us back to that kind of definition and what, like, people brought up about, like, how there's, like, a diverse amount of people who experience this.
Was your New Year's resolution to quit your daily Starbucks and stick to homemade coffee? Did you stop eating fast food and finally start using that air fryer you bought 6 months ago? Well, I have an idea on how you can spend all that money you saved. Donate it to Intersections so that we can get a new transmitter and you can continue to hear from us every 2 weeks. All you need to do is go to citr.ca/donate and select the Intersections dropdown. Fund Drive will be on from February 2nd to the 9th, but you can also give us money anytime you want.
Okay, so for my what's out for 2023, I'm saying performative activism, because frankly, I think this should have been out always for all years, not just 2023. So as I would define performative activism, it would be like supporting a cause just for social justice clout instead of for any personal reasons. So this can be in the form of, like, certain Instagram posts, or I know a lot of people who would, like, go to protests just for the photo op. And obviously, in theory, posting something isn't unethical. Going to a protest, even if it's for a photo, isn't unethical. But there's a lot of situations in which doing these things is actually diminishing and drowning out other people who have actual real things to say about these causes. So one, like, very infamous example of that would be the Blackout Tuesday debacle that happened in 2020 during the Black Lives Matter protests about George Floyd. So basically what that was the people were posting a black square on their Instagram to, like, wipe out their feed, I guess, and, like, in theory, promote awareness. So there was actually 14.6 million posts in one day of a black screen, which, if we're looking at a sheer number, that's, like, insane. If that black screen had had any information on it, I don't know, maybe it would have been different. But because there was so many posts, what actually happened was people that were at these protests or had actual, you know, things to say about the cause, that were involved, that were personally affected by them, their voices and their information was drowned out by other people who were, quote unquote, supporting their cause. And these protests were also very kind of important protests in the way that the protesters were treated as well. Lots of information about how the protesters were treated, such as, especially in the US, they were being tear gassed, they were being shot with rubber bullets, there were some fatalities, people were being abducted by unmarked police cars, things like that. That kind of information was completely drowned out by these black squares. And so what I have to say about performative activism is, I'm not saying you have to be at a protest and like fully committing your entire life to a cause to support it. But I do think that there's a difference between mentally or emotionally supporting a cause and being someone with the label of an activist who is doing activism. I think you can side with a cause and side with a certain mentality without being an actual activist. And I think that in our kind of social media generation, that term activist, along with a lot of other social justice terms, are getting washed out. There is a really good quote I found in this article, an article from a university paper, actually, that I'm going off of a little bit, that said that activism takes time and change takes effort. So I think that that's just really good for people who are like, oh no, I don't want to be, you know, only performative in my activism. I do care about this thing. So if you want to enact any sort of change, it takes effort and it takes time. And something like posting a square only on Instagram doesn't take effort or time. So if you actually care about something and you want to help, you need to take time and effort, essentially. Another thing along with that, another situation was change.org petitions. Personally, I saw one kind of recently, maybe like 6 months ago, that was for the Uyghur Muslims in China, which is obviously a very important cause and something that should, like, awareness should be spread about. However, I don't know if a change.org petition will influence the Chinese government very much about their treatment of these people. And in 2020, change.org had 2 billion signatures on all of their petitions. And there's very little actual change that has come from these petitions, just because they don't hold up a lot of the time in courts, or like politicians don't take them seriously, because once again, they don't take very much effort and they don't take very much time. So I just think that when people say that things like Instagram posting or change.org petitions are promoting awareness, I think that a lot of the people who would see these things and would share them and would participate in a petition or a post or repost or things like that are people who have already seen it and would agree, would be inclined to agree. So I think it's more of a situation of reinforcing beliefs you already have and kind of reinforcing beliefs that you and your friends share, rather than spreading actual awareness, because social media makes it very easy to just click past a petition or a post. So yeah, I guess, what's your guys' thoughts on that?
Yeah, just to add on to even what you mentioned about that is like the lack of time and sort of resources it takes, and also the lack of self-reflection that anybody has to put into it. I know a lot of people, because I'm from a very small town, very conservative and very racist small town in Ontario, where tons of people I knew from high school posted it, just like jumping onto the bandwagon. And then I was like, you've said some really controversial, horrible things in the past that, like, I don't think you're taking the time to actually consider how you're contributing to this overall systemic problem. You're just like, oh, it's a black square, I'll post it. Like, I don't have to consider my own actions and how they've affected anyone.
Yeah, so this also reminded me of like the episode that we recorded, that Intersections recorded during Pride Month, about rainbow capitalism, about how like when it comes time for Pride Month, like some businesses, they kind of like gypsies are being changed, or like if you're actually being directed to resources, like helpful resources, to kind of like learn more about certain issues. And so yeah, like the whole phenomenon with the black square kind of like reminded me of that. And also like, yeah, the way the change.org petitions are shared, like if there were certain issues like pertaining to, I guess, like our local governments, local issues, like in my, like people might have like some awareness after they see change.org petitions. But if it's like governments overseas, like when we're not really sure if like they're paying attention to these kinds of topics, then yeah, it's a bit unclear like if like sharing like a headline from change.org like would actually lead to like certain systemic steps taken to address the issue. And so yeah, because like having received like a lot of different like change.org kind of like petitions like through email after I signed one that was like to do with like, I think it was something about eliminating single-use plastics on the UBC campus. Like that one actually did go through and it did lead to some kind of changes in like the way that campus like promotes like trying to use less single-use plastics, but like for like larger issues, yeah, probably more has to be done than simply sharing something on social media or like sharing a kind of headline from change.org petition.
Hey, this is Phoebe from Intersections, your favorite student radio show that somehow manages to talk about systemic racism, Twilight, and Watergate all in one 90-minute episode. If that sounds enticing to you, you can catch more Intersections every other Tuesday at 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. But enough about our amazing show. It's February, which means that love is in the air, and so is Fun Drive, the one time of year when you listeners are lucky enough to hear us beg and plead for your financial support, because I know that you are totally into that sort of thing. Instead of taking your partner out for that romantic dinner or buying them chocolates or flowers, why not spend some money supporting local student radio? I can't think of a more romantic gesture than that. Who doesn't love a philanthropist? CITR helps platform annoying Gen Zers like me to talk at you on the radio, so the least you can do is show some gratitude in the form of cold hard cash. Visit citr.ca/donate to donate. That's citr.ca/donate. Thanks for your support.
Hi. Okay, so my out for the year is, and I want to be really specific here, it's like mental health resource lists, and the list is just a list of hotlines from outside sources, completely irrelevant to the institution sharing this list. So this has definitely been around for a while. But it kind of came back in my mind because I got one from like my residence during exam stress, and it was just on the brain. And it really reminded me of this time in high school I had, and my school board constantly would be like, we have all these great resources, like check out our resources if you're struggling. And I would always look, just even out of curiosity. And every single time, time and time and again, it would be the exact same list of outside source hotlines. And this was the same institution. Like I went to my guidance counselor. I didn't have the greatest high school experience. And I was like, you know, I'm really not doing my best. I'm worried about how I'm going to perform this year. And I don't want to have it interfere with my classes. I'm trying to be proactive. Like, is there anything I can do? Any like accommodations we can set me up with? And the advice he gave me was, the best thing that you could probably do to succeed is take a fifth year. And they had nothing else to provide me, nothing else to offer me. But then, you know, performatively, which is kind of going back to what Serena was just talking about this performative activism is like these institutions perpetrating these lists of resources, you know. And I think that when it comes to resources on mental health from different institutions, what comes to mind mostly for me is educational institutions, is that you as an institution are not going to fix an individual's mental health. You are not going to be able to provide them the best access to care and treatments and help them on their mental health journey. What would be, I think in my mind, much, much more effective and really would lead to tangible change across the board if this was happening in multiple places, is providing resources within your own institution to allow people with mental health problems to be able to function better and have more flexibility and accommodation within structured society. And I think that that's something that, I mean, maybe I just haven't heard talked about a lot, but I don't really hear people talk about, is that like structured society is really difficult for people with mental health issues. There's specific times of the day that you need to be places, you need to be functional at specific hours and have these very strict deadlines. And it doesn't fit with someone who is constantly going through these difficult struggles, and their up and day reality is not as plain and simple as this deadline, this time schedule, that. And I think that within education, we need to be providing resources that allow you to function within what is going on around you. And I am just so sick of seeing these outside sources that do not enable anybody to really engage in any better way. Like there's no follow through on that. And it's not like these are hotlines, you know, because I'm aware of the UBC like sexual assault hotline that's set up for the UBC campus so that you can call things in. And there's things like Safe Walk, which will take you to a direct situation that will help you. But those are hotlines built for this institution. If you're providing a list of hotlines for outside of the institution, that's just something that somebody can find as access to public knowledge. You know, like if someone was super struggling and they were looking for a suicide hotline, they can find a suicide hotline. Providing that in an email is not what's going to help somebody. So yeah, I think I'm gonna open it up if anybody wants to make any comments on that. I feel like I broached the topic enough.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Ava. I think my other beef, just like with hotlines in general, is like they are super important and they play a role, but they take so much responsibility away from institutions that could do more preventative care, because a hotline is not preventative care. It's like a last minute, like very like, you know, just like an immediate, like not even solution. It's just like you're literally trying to prevent something terrible from happening, or like dealing with the after effects of something terrible. So I know that they play a role, but I think, yeah, just like for me, like when UBC just constantly is like, oh, you can call this hotline, you can call this hotline. It's just like, well, you could just hire professors and create a culture that, you know, allows us to, you know, cater to our mental health and actually, like, you know, take care of our bodies and our minds. And instead of creating this like crushing academic institution that leads to situations, you know, that cause our mental health to deteriorate at such a rapid rate that we need like an emergency, you know, solution. So I agree with you.
I think my point also jumps onto this idea of like institutional mental health resources, because I feel that a lot of universities don't correctly advertise their mental health resources well enough. I found this personally with UBC as well, where they say that they have a ton of mental health resources and they can connect you with anyone and there's very little wait lists. And then when you actually contact them, they're like, if it can't be resolved in like one short wellness talk, then you should go and find like an outside counselor. And I was like, oh, okay. But like, I could have done that just from the start if you had just advertised that you can only offer a 20-minute quick like wellness, get it off your chest check that's not going to require any follow-up care or anything like that, versus instead you promoted this idea that like you have a ton of mental health resources, you have like a whole team, and then it's not really a team of mental health resources, it's just like a couple people who are like, have you ever tried meditating, it can be helpful. And I'm like, that's not really where I'm at, like looking for some resources. But yeah, that's my issue with institutions as well.
No, and just to add on to that, totally, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've like called these hotlines and things at UBC where they give you information and they're like, well, I'm going to be really honest with you. And this was the best thing I've ever heard from them, is they were like, you know, given what you're telling me, you'd be better to just get outside practice. Like, as much as I can give you the list of people within UBC, because there is a list. And like, that's the thing is UBC, it's like, oh, we have a list of people. Technically, we've done the right thing. But then it's not actually helpful to the specific targeted group that it's supposed to be helping, which is just such a failure. And I think that that's another example of there's a lack of like preventative cares, because if people had access to this consistent like seeking, then we wouldn't have to rely on hotlines so much.
Yeah, like you just mentioned, like consistency is like the key. Like if someone only sees like a bunch of links to like external places where you can get help, then it may not really help much. And this reminded me of like that social media page, UBC Confessions. Like there's some people who they've given accounts of what they're going through on there. And I feel like a lot of the times it's actually the conversation between people posting on their post that helps them a bit more. Obviously the moderators, they would always try to post a list of links, like if you need immediate help, go to this. But like a lot of the times, yeah, I do find it's like the ongoing conversation around these topics. Just like some years ago when there was like a string of gender-based assaults on campus, like there was this, I think the school started this kind of campaign where they like, they might put up like some posters, like this is what consent looks like. And like seeing that kind of conversation like around campus, even if it's like only on paper, like it helps a bit more than like simply giving out a list, like where can you go? Because some people, they're dealing with like situation, it's things that are maybe situational too. And sometimes it takes some kind of like encouraging boost that's more than just like, go to this specific place, like you need help like this. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that overall, just a general consensus for the conversation is just that help looks like a lot of different ways, and one specific type of help is not it.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Juliana from the fabulous Intersection Show, which is on air every 2 weeks, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. One thing I love about our Intersection Show is that it opens up a space to have important conversations about gender, race, and social justice. But it also allows me and my collective members to share our thoughts with you live on the air. Although, we're actually not always live on air. The first time I came to the studio, I went on a bit of a tangent about Watergate and Nixon. I guess I was just very excited to be in the studio in person for the first time ever. It's really cool. But after that tangent, we have yet to record another show in person. Coincidence? I guess I'll leave that up to you to decide. All jokes aside, I've learned so much from my collective members and the conversations we've been having this year. And as a new student at UBC, joining CITR has also helped me feel so welcomed and connected to the UBC community, which is why the work that CITR is doing is so important. At Campus Radio, we have important conversations and we're able to make the coolest friendships. But we can't keep shows like Intersections on the air without your help. This week is Fund Drive here at CITR. It's the one time each year where we ask for your support to help keep local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. If you're in a position to contribute, please visit citr.ca/donate to donate. And for more on Watergate and my ramblings, check out citr.ca/radio/intersections/. Catch you next Tuesday.
So, hi, I'm Randy. My out for 2023 is... basically, it boils down to like gatekeeping queer terminology, but I'm going to try to explain it because I was thinking about this for so long and I need to like talk about it. So basically, it's like the discourse of continuing to define like queer terminology, such as the word lesbian, to a point where it focuses on so much on what it's not and not what it is. So examples of this on TikTok, I don't know how long ago this was. There was this, I don't even know who made the video, but someone made a video about a trans man who just started transitioning and they were continuing to use the word lesbian. And all of these people were in like a huge uproar of like, you can't do that, you can't do that. And like inserting themselves into this person's life and just like giving this opinion that like doesn't matter. And then also my other example is like the internet's war between the definitions of bisexuality and pansexuality. And like, you know, like who is a TERF and who's not. So then it kind of like goes into this like idea of like ticking boxes of like queerness to go into these spaces. So the example that I want to talk about, because when I first explained this to my roommate, they're like, that's great, but it's super academic. And I was like, yeah, that's fair. So I'm bringing my personal experience into this. So I only have brought straight people to drag shows because basically all of my friends are straight and they loved it. Like they have a great time, but there's this idea of like, you know, it's bad and it's dangerous to bring straight people into queer spaces. And so what I'm trying to get at is like this idea, it's not the identity and like, you know, having these terms, it's the way that you treat the space and the way you care for it. So another example is I took my 63-year-old white farmer dad to my roommate's art show, which was a movie about drag performers, and he liked it. He had a lot of questions, but that's just him with art. He doesn't understand art, especially modern art. But he enjoyed it. And, you know, he was respectful of that space. And so I think that's like a huge thing. I also am now going to shout out my roommate's upcoming drag show. So they're hosting Magic Dykes on February 10th. It's hosted by Skim. So you should go. It's at the Warehouse. It's going to be super fun. It's for all lesbians and lesbian lovers. But yeah, just to go back to my actual point of like what's out. So that was kind of like my concrete example. But to bring it back to like the definition of like these queer terms, it doesn't allow for like individuality and nuance to these experiences that like queerness to me is about. And so I think it just brings about like using these terms as like badges that symbolize like one's progressiveness and like one's essentially like spot in the club, which, you know, it just creates more boxes. And I'm here in 2023 to destroy boxes. So yeah, I'm curious to hear other people's thoughts.
Well, let me just say, as someone in the queer community, let me tell you, you are preaching to the choir. Say it louder. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. And I have a lot of nuance, especially with the word lesbian. You know, I'm in a gay relationship. And like within the gay relation, well, the thing is my girlfriend's non-binary. And so we don't like when from like an outside source, like people call it like a lesbian relationship, but like on the inside, like a lot of our experience is like defined by being queer. And I'll get into this later, like with my in, but you know, there's so much nuance to lesbianism and a lot of it is lived experience. And so that's why the label doesn't really make sense when somebody else says it to us. But from the inside, it's something that we can talk about because it's about our lived experience and the specific nuances that have happened to us. And so I think that it's really great that we can, you know, hopefully expand the use of some things.
Yeah, and to tack onto that too, while I agree that like TikTok is really great for a lot of things and giving a lot of platforms, I've also seen a lot of toxicity in the queer community on TikTok. Specifically, I've had people I know that have posted things just trying to like, as they're beginning to explore their sexualities, especially because a lot of us moved out of small towns to big cities. And the idea of just getting attacked online for like calling yourself bisexual, but never having been or having another experience with another woman. And like a lot of people just coming out and being like, no, you're bi curious. You can't assert yourself as being a bisexual person yet if you haven't had that experience. And for a lot of people that I knew, it just became such a thing that stopped them from wanting to try anything more and explore their sexuality further, because they felt that even from, they moved from feeling very condensed into a box in a small town to then feeling like they didn't have space to grow into the queer community and really expand their knowledge. And most of it was just from like TikTok hate, that not even from like the people around them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's just kind of part of somewhat of a pendulum swing that happens to a lot of oppressed communities. And I'm not saying it's bad or unfounded or anything. I just think it tends to happen where people who have been oppressed in certain ways will try to create a safe space that will get attacked for being that space. And they'll say, okay, we need this to be very, very exclusive. We need this to be very, very private. And we need to monitor exactly who is in it, exactly how they're in it, exactly what's going on in every way. And obviously, like the queer community globally, that's like billions of people. So it's kind of done in a different way than other kind of more time and place specific communities would be. But I think like, once again, kind of how I mentioned in my out, but like this TikTok generation, not to use a term like that, but it ends up kind of gatekeeping certain things because I think people get afraid of what could happen if it's not kept exclusive. But I think that can be very reductive to a lot of different people's experiences within those kinds of labels and maybe the experiences that they want to have going forward.
Yeah, I think just like very quickly to wrap it up, I agree with what all you're saying. And yeah, I feel like my, you know, when I search out for like friends, for example, like I'm looking for people that are aligned with me, like politically, empathetically, and like that isn't only defined in like what term do you use as part of the like queer community, which I will also talk about more in my in.
$10 latte?
Siegel got your fiver?
$63 digital textbook?
$8 Twitter blue checkmark?
What have you been doing with your money? Tinder Plus?
And Tinder Gold.
Do you pay for pre-rolls at dispensaries instead of just learning to roll?
Hot water bill. Really?
Oh, and that our Terex beanie isn't worth your last paycheck.
You even got your Uncle Walter a Bob Ross Funko Pop for his 45th birthday party, a party that you had to ask to get invited to, and you had to go to f***ing Burnaby for that
Plus, we know the price of eggs and your organic produce.
Want to know a better way to spend your money? Donate to the CITR Intersectionality Collective.
You can donate by going to www.citr.ca/donate. That's www.citr.ca/donate. And don't forget to select the Intersectionality Collective. It's either that or keep lighting your f***ing money on fire.
Let's head into our what's in for 2023. So we'll kick it off with Brianna. Do you want to take us away?
Okay. My in for 2023 is shockingly about another book thing. And mine is about, I don't know if anyone else has had it, but because I spent an
like absurd amount of time on Book Talk. This revitalization of the Hunger Games trilogy has been a huge thing for like the past month. And it's just been really growing. And I think it brings up a lot of discourse again about the Hunger Games trilogy. And specifically when you look at literature analysis of the Hunger Games versus the movie analysis of the Hunger Games, and the sort of failure on the part of movie producers to stay true to the actual meaning of the books. A lot of people discerned the meaning, but then I see a lot of people online who are like, the Hunger Games is a romance triangle. And I'm like, absolutely not. This is not what the book was meant to be. It's meant to be a societal critique. You're getting it very, very wrong. And because A Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, the movie, is coming out in November, I found that it was particularly pressing to be one of my ins for 2023, because I think that I also reread all of the books over the Christmas break because I absolutely adore them as a piece of young adult literature and the start of like the really good start of young female dystopian main characters. I would argue that Katniss Everdeen is probably one of, if not the, at the time that this became like a very big genre, the best representation of like a young female main character teenager that wasn't completely like destroyed by media critics and just like the general treatment that a lot of female main characters get in the media. And so that was my topic. I'm wondering if anybody else like still cares about the Hunger Games the way that I do, because one of my professors in my undergrad wrote like 3 books on the Hunger Games and like the looks of like race, politics, gender in the Hunger Games and representation. So I've had deep obsession for a long time, and I just want to know what other people think about the Hunger Games, because I love it.
I think that that's such a good in for this year, because I am also highly anticipating this prequel movie. When I read the book, I was like, oh, this is so good. I cannot wait to see it. So I'm hoping maybe, especially with all this like rehashing of like what the book really is about, if there will maybe be some better, you know, meaning with the movie this time. I don't want to get my hopes up too high, you know, but I'm saving a little sliver of hope, especially given the thematics and book. I don't want to spoil anything, so I won't get into too much, but I'm also very excited.
Yeah, so I read Hunger Games. I have no idea how old I was, but I remember I borrowed the books from my neighbor who like took them from his sister and lent them to me. It was such a weird time in my life. But yeah, I definitely agree. I also think like the place that the Hunger Games holds is like the start of that. And like Divergent came after that, and the ways in which Divergent just like fell like off a cliff. Like it it didn't hold a candle to the Hunger Games, right? I think most people agree with that. But I think like what I will say is like, yes, I think it's so important to like, you know, recognize the like cultural impact that the Hunger Games was. But I think also within that, like holding a lot of space, especially on Book Talk and in the book world, for like girl-led dystopian fiction that's more diverse. Cause like the Hunger Games didn't really hit that mark as much. And so I think, yeah, in 2023, I definitely agree with you. I think that's the right word. Yeah, I'm getting some nods to the Hunger Games, but then also like using that as a way to like open up more conversations about like more diverse like YA dystopian fiction. And yeah, I agree with that. I'm so here for that.
Yeah, and that's just jumping in as well. I think what kind of is hopefully, again, another like 2023 book related in for me is going to be the new Percy Jackson series, because I think that they are doing an incredible job. I know that they've received a lot of online backlash about like not staying true to Annabeth's character, but I think they're doing a really incredible job of taking the original series and staying true to it while still adding in a lot more diversity that even the author recognized that he didn't have at the time, even though I think it was still one of the most diverse, specifically like young reader, like 9 to 12 book series of its time. But I think they're doing an incredible job with implementing that now into another kind of way. And like, again, changing the race of characters should not matter a whole lot to increase diversity when the character is very, very well written and very well rounded. And I think it's going to be excellent representation, especially because Annabeth I think, especially because it's being portrayed by a Black woman now, a Black girl, is going to be incredible because she's represented as being such a strong, brilliant character that I think that it's really just going to hit the mark, hopefully. And then one other final quick in that I have, and again, this is because I'm obsessed with like certain types of media, is if anyone has any perspectives on like Avatar and the way that James Cameron implemented a lot of, didn't hit the mark 100% of the time, but I think he did very well in inclusive writing, especially because he took so many things that were drawn from Indigenous communities and working very closely with those Indigenous communities that he drew from in order to make sure that he was correctly representing them.
That's so interesting because I only heard negative things about the new Avatar and the ways in which he like depicted Indigenous people. But I truly have not watched the film nor like read any actual like things. This is the internet talking through me. Okay. I'm so curious to like read more.
Oh yeah, same. I haven't seen the second Avatar film. But I've seen the first one, like it gets people thinking about like certain themes that everyone just mentioned. And so about the reviews and like a lot of the other reactions that Randy had just mentioned, I guess maybe that could be something that we could go into when we record another episode, but yeah.
I have seen both movies. So speaking as someone who has seen them, let me tell you, I am so sorry, but I only heard negative things and I have only heard those things. I think that Avatar brings a lot of awareness to a very important theme, but I think when it comes down to the key details of a lot of the movie and the portrayal of Indigenous communities, it really fails. And maybe this is something that we'll have to dive into in another episode.
Interested in more content like what you just heard? Fascinated with topics concerning social justice and occasional pop culture references? This Fund Drive season, donate to Intersections to help us continue to support local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. From February 2nd to 9th, just select Intersections at the drop-down menu at citr.ca/donate. All prize levels include previous levels. Thanks in advance.
Okay, yeah, so I think what we just covered was a great segue into my topic, which is, in my personal opinion, the in for this year. And this is that more stories directed by women and for women are emerging in the film landscape. So even though women are still underrepresented in filmmaking, so first I'll just run through some stats that illustrate this and then go into why I think that this is, it's like still an in for like more stories by women to emerge. So right now we have 7% of women working as cinematographers, and this is a 3% increase from 1998. We have 21% of female editors, 19% writers, 25% female executive producers, and 31% female producers. However, I still think that these stories are like continuing, these stories like by female directors are continuing to like make their way like into film in general. And so I guess the discussion that I would like to put forth to everyone is there's like a list that's been compiled of like female directed films to watch for this year. And so like on the list, the six films are like Woman Talking, After Sun, The Woman King, Till, She Said, and Saint Omer. And so the reviews for these films, they cite like these are stories with a lot of richness and complexity, which I think is pretty important. Because like we mentioned in a previous Intersections episode, a lot of like previous Oscar-worthy films that men made, like usually like they try to portray these stories as like more complex, but they usually like involve like the use of like a lot of portrayal of like female trauma and like violence. That was something that Serena touched on in that previous episode on film violence that we did for intersections. And so this new trend is like kind of like portraying the fact that like female directors can also produce stories with a lot of richness and complexity, but like there is a wide range of like inner worlds that are portrayed from female led perspectives. So yeah, I was wondering if like anyone either like has seen these this list of films, planning to see this list of films, and what do they think about the general trend in general for emerging female directors or female directors that are already working in the field. And also, if you want to comment on like Hunger Games, on how that relates to that. That was one thing I thought of when Brianna mentioned Hunger Games.
Yeah, I think that I haven't seen, she said, like the movie, but I read the book written by the two authors. So I think hopefully that they're closely related. I thought that was a really incredible book, talking about like opening up the culture of sexual assault and sexual violence in Hollywood. And it was also a really good book because it didn't go into depth to like make its point and make the central point violence against women. It was more about the impact of violence on women, but like it's not gratuitously telling you all these details that you really don't need to know. And to touch on female directors, this isn't in the list, but it's coming up, so it kind of fits into the in. I'm really excited for Greta Gerwig's Barbie, just because of all of the discourse that's been going on already, and Greta Gerwig has really done a lot of fantastic things before, and so I'm so excited to hopefully this will be like a really good cultural hit for Barbie to be like a good feminist portrayal.
Yeah, Barbie from a female-led perspective, yeah, that's something I think it appeared on another review list, but yeah, I'm excited to kind of see what that would be like too.
Okay, so I just thought of this and I have to bring it up. So the when I like think about like, you know, the rise of like female directors and like, you know, directors who aren't men and like, you know, the role that they play in film, I immediately thought of this YouTube video by Folding Ideas, and the title is A Lukewarm Defense of 50 Shades of Grey. And I don't know if anyone knows much about the 50 Shades of Grey movie. I've seen them all repeated times. And like the first one is so much better than the rest. And you know why that is? Because a woman directed the first movie, and the ways in which, please go watch this video by Folding Ideas, the ways in which he like unravels like how having like, you know, like, yeah, like a woman director or like even like a woman showrunner or like women behind the scenes and like the change that has for like set and like the way the story is written and the way it's captured. Yeah, I think that's, sorry, I don't know how related this is at all. I feel like you're talking about Oscar films and I'm like, let's talk about 50 Shades of Grey, but please go watch this video. I think it's like very interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't have to only like be Oscar films. I'm just like in general, like the thing, it's just that there was like a trend before of like in the film critic circle, like in order to be an Oscar worthy film, there were like certain things that people, certain trends that people try to adapt to. But like, yeah, in general, we're just, yeah, talking about like female led films, so.
Yeah, just like what was said before about like you being excited for Barbie and like female-led movies and just like in general that they're more accurate portrayals. I'm gonna just take the other side just for a moment because I think that it's a little bit risky to almost idolize female directors just for their gender, because it doesn't always work out that they meet your expectations, even if you want them to. And I'm not saying like, down with female directors, nothing like that. I'm just saying like, I was thinking about Don't Worry, Darling, which, disclaimer, I haven't seen, but I've read a lot about. And I've heard a lot of people saying that Olivia Wilde, even though she's like, yeah, this is like feminist masterpiece, I've had it like a lot of people saying that they disagree with their portrayals, and sure that she brings up some points, but they're just not very developed. And I think that, I don't know anything about her as a person or as a director, like I'm not speaking to her like specifically, but I just think that even if the director, or like you said, a showrunner is a woman and it's, you know, a story that's about women, it's not always going to work out as well as you would hope, whether that's the fault of the director or the fault of just the fact that they're operating within still a very masculine and very patriarchal system. I don't know about Olivia Wilde, but that movie just made me think of it as just like one female director can't fix the whole situation that this movie might have been filmed in, that might have been developed in. The producers might still be not just men, but people with like intentions of making the movie not have the kind of representation that people perhaps hope that it would.
Yeah, on that point, when it comes to the film, like Woman Talking, one of the lead actors in there, Claire Foy, like she admitted that, quote unquote, I'd be lying if I felt there was an overall fixing in progress when it comes to these issues, and that's going to come with the next generation, and it's not an easy fix. And so, yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see like what would happen like if a separate Hunger Games was directed by like a woman. Would it be different or would it be not? Because the original novel was written by a woman, but the film happened to be made by a man. So if there was like another version, like what would the reviews look like and like how would people react? That's like something that if it ever did happen, then that would be really cool thing to look into.
Was your New Year's resolution to quit your daily Starbucks and stick to homemade coffee? Did you stop eating fast food and finally start using that air fryer you bought 6 months ago? Well, I have an idea on how you can spend all that money you've saved. Donate it to Intersections so that we can get a new transmitter and you can continue to hear from us every 2 weeks. All you need to do is go to citr.ca/donate and select the Intersections dropdown. Fund Drive will be on from February 2nd to the 9th, but you can also give us money anytime you want.
So for my in for 2023, I'm saying that intersectional feminist literature is in for 2023. So in my mind, this means I was thinking of four good examples. So I was thinking Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, Angela Davis, and Adrienne Rich. And my kind of idea for my in, I was just going to do like tiny little profile on each of them. I don't know if the listeners are interested, they can look one of them up. But I guess I was just thinking about like going off of my out, which is performative activism. I was thinking to me personally, who do I actually consider to be a true activist? What kind of person is this? And I think that it's somebody that would develop writings or work of any kind that hold true decades later and are like very influential to not just movements that they're part of, but like literally defining movements. And I thought that all four of these people did this. So for Bell Hooks, her two, I guess, largest or like more popular pieces of work are Feminism is for Everybody and Ain't I a Woman? So she mainly talks about the intersectionality of race, capitalism, and gender, and how those three together produce systems of oppression and perpetuate them. And then Audre Lorde, her biggest works are Sister Outsider and Your Silence Will Not Protect You. And she explores the intersections of being Black, female, lesbian, and how it relates to class and women's roles in society. Angela Davis, her biggest works are Women, Race, and Class, and Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And her work has a lot to do with the prison abolition movement. She was a member of the Black Panthers, and she coined the term prison industrial complex, which I don't know about you guys, but being an art student, I've heard that term a lot. She was also, fun fact, the 1971 Woman of the Year, but she's still a very controversial figure despite all the work that she has produced. And then finally, Adrienne Rich, her biggest works are Diving into the Wreck, Compulsory Heterosexuality and Lesbian Existence, and finally, Woman Born, or of Woman Born, sorry. And she was nominated for a National Book Award alongside Audre Lorde, actually, which she won. And her poems, she's a poet versus a lot of the other ones write prose. They're mostly about women's roles in society. They're kind of impassioned, angry poems. And she is said to be one of the most widely read feminist poets. And she has, according to one literary critic, brought oppression of women and lesbians to the forefront of discourse as she's criticized rigid forms of feminist identities. So yeah, I have a few quotes from them that to me spoke to me a lot about what they were saying, but I want to ask first if there's anybody else who knows about this topic and would have anything to add.
Yeah, hello, this is Randy, who reads a lot, and I fully support this. I have said this forever. If people picked up books and read them, then I wouldn't have to explain so much stuff. And I definitely think like a great, and I personally support people reading bell hooks all the time, because the way in which bell hooks approaches her writing is extremely accessible. She very much is not writing to be part of this very rigid academia that, like, you know, like Judith Butler and Michelle Foucault, that's very much like pushing people out if you can't understand these like very technical terms and ideas. So I support this. And I just want to say, bell hooks has a book, The Will to Change, that's about men and masculinity and love. Definitely recommend that book. It fully changed my life. And I think it changed a lot of people in my family's life.
Yeah, yeah. The quote that I had saved for me personally that really spoke to me from bell hooks was, she says, quote unquote, "To understand feminism, it implies one has to necessarily understand sexism," which I just think is a really interesting way to put it, because even in this quote, it's slightly ambiguous as to whether she agrees with this or not. But I think it just brings up a good point that, like, a lot of the time, if you're understood to be somebody who's well-read or progressive or something, you're supposed to be able to fully understand the other side of it too, which sure can be helpful for, you know, combating that kind of mentality. But also a lot of these things, speaking from like my personal opinion, is that I don't understand as a person how you would believe these things. And so it's good to understand where they come from, to understand the movements against them, like feminism versus sexism. But also I find it personally very difficult to plainly just understand sexism. Like, I personally don't understand it, but I understand why bell hooks would suggest looking into it to understand her takes on feminism.
This is another quick, like, intersectionality kind of related author, Jeanette Winterson. She wrote Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit and Written on the Body, I consider to be one of like the best, like, ambiguous, because it comes from an androgynous narration perspective. And so it's just like a really good recommendation if you're looking for like narrative story prose books as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that almost makes me think of the quote that I had from Audre Lorde, which is actually, she says, Audre Lorde, a lot of her work is about how she felt excluded from a lot of movements by her intersections of identity being Black, female, and lesbian, and how a lot of those groups don't, in theory, correlate to each other, but in actuality they do. So her quote is, quote unquote, "There is a pretense to a homogeneity of experience covered by the word sisterhood that does not in fact exist." And in this, she's speaking about her experience with feminist movements and how exclusive they are to her as a Black female lesbian. And yeah, I think it's really cool that there is books about these kinds of things written from an androgynous perspective, kind of helps to open that exclusivity a little bit.
Hey, this is Phoebe from Intersections, your favorite student radio show that somehow manages to talk about systemic racism, Twilight, and Watergate all in one 90-minute episode. If that sounds enticing to you, you can catch more Intersections every other Tuesday at 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. But enough about our amazing show. It's February, which means that love is in the air, and so is Fun Drive, the one time of year when you listeners are lucky enough to hear us beg and plead for your financial support, because I know that you are totally into that sort of thing. Instead of taking your partner out for that romantic dinner or buying them chocolates or flowers, why not spend some money supporting local student radio? I can't think of a more romantic gesture than that. Who doesn't love a philanthropist? CITR helps platform annoying Gen Zers like me to talk at you on the radio, so the least you can do is show some gratitude in the form of cold hard cash. Visit citr.ca/donate to donate. That's citr.ca/donate. Thanks for your support.
Okay, so my in for this year is being gay in public. This is highly personal to me. Just this week, my girlfriend flew over from Toronto to come visit me in Vancouver. And no, I don't want to say that I forgot. what it's like to be gay in public. But it's just one of those things where we couldn't even get through the bus ride home from the airport without having like a group of like tween, like 10, 11 skater boys, like making fun of us and like mocking us, doing like impressions of us, you know, just holding hands in public and stuff. And, you know, obviously talking about the struggles about being gay in public opens up a lot of discussions about hate crimes, but I just want to keep this a little bit more lighthearted. And just in 2023, I hope that there is a lot more normalization, specifically of public displays of affection for gay couples in public, because it's something that to me, when I'm doing it, it just feels very normal and it's very minimal. And it's something that you just don't even notice the straight people around you doing, but it becomes such, I don't want to say like an obvious when you're gay, but you know, I definitely feel that way when I'm experiencing it. And it's not always like this, you know what I mean? There's definitely situations where it feels just as normal as if I wasn't gay. And I'm hoping that by, you know, it's staying a bit more, you know, in, then hopefully it will stay more normal. And, you know, it extends past just, you know, being gay, you know, like whenever we're out in public, servers and stuff always like to refer to me and my girlfriend as like, oh, hey, girls, hey, ladies, you know, there's a lot of very specific things, you know, pertaining to being gay in public. And I'm hoping that there's a little bit less commentary from outside sources, maybe in 2023. I don't know. Does anyone else have anything else to say about this?
Yeah, so there was a report released by UBC sometime last spring around like, yeah, April 2022, about how like a new report shows improvements in LGBTQ lives and health, but more work is needed. So what you just highlighted there, yeah, like a kind of like, it's kind of like still like putting people into like certain boxes, like what Randy mentioned. And so, yeah, more work is definitely needed there. And so, yeah. Yeah, so I guess like we can go through like some other points in the article that I thought was interesting. So like other trends that emerged were like the amount of stigma and discrimination that LGBT youth face. It's like slowly decreasing. But like it's been like obviously it's like been 15 years since I think since this study said that kind of that was like examined. And so that means like there's still significant gaps. Like it took like a really long time even to get to this point. So like, yeah, I like a lot of like the constructive like discussions like we've been having and stuff. Cause you said this is like just kind of like in regular like situation that you're in, but you still feel like there's like a huge kind of like hurdle here. And so, yeah, go ahead, Randy.
What you said, Ava, like it's definitely, it rings true. It feels like in, you know, 2023, it shouldn't be a big deal for, you know, to, you know, femme identifying people or even, you know, like to noticeably like a non-heterosexual couple holding hands or kissing in public. But it still is. I mean, it 100% is. And you basically just have to go out anywhere in society to notice that. And it is like incredibly harmful. And also like the other levels that we have, like, you know, the ways in which that like stigmatization changes based on what you look like. It makes it so like, yeah, being gay in public, it feels like, yeah, that should be, you know, it's not illegal. Like it's, you're literally just being a person. But unfortunately, like our society, I think got caught up on that. I just want to put this out. I think this is funny because I am hugely anti-PDA just like as a person. I'm ace, so it makes me extremely uncomfortable when anyone does it, but I will always support queer people more than like straight people. Like I'm the person that like will make fun of my straight friends that are in heterosexual relationships for displaying PDA, whereas like I will not make those same comments because I am so aware that like it is a completely different experience. But yeah, I agree with you. In 2023, just be gay in public, like, you know, and everyone should support that. Okay. All you supposed allies, this goes on Serena's thing, you know, we're out, performative activism is out, supportive activism is in, which means that you protect people that are publicly gay. That sounded Thank weird. I want to edit that out.
Because that's such a great point, because you know what? I have never once in public ever been supported by anyone surrounding me, you know? I've been hate crime multiple times, and you know, people just sort of look around and they're like, wow, that was awkward. And it's definitely not the kindest response that could be given. And I think that the number one thing that LGBTQ people need from allies is true supportive allyship. And that involves like real in the moment reactions. It's not just, I support gay people. Obviously, if you're gay in public, it's great, you know, because everyone's going to say that, you know what I mean? But then once you're in that situation and you're witnessing going down, yes, it is awkward to say something. Yes, it is hard. You know what? It is 10 times harder for the person in the LGBT community to say it than it is for you to help them out in that situation. And having somebody to have your back really makes a difference. And I don't really know if people who are allies will ever really have an understanding of just how impactful it can be to be supportive in those kinds of situations. So yeah, be supportive of gay people. It's in for 2023, be gay in public.
$10 latte?
Seagull got your fiver?
$63 digital textbook?
$8 Twitter blue checkmark?
What have you been doing with your money? Tinder Plus?
And Tinder Gold?
Do you pay for pre-rolls at dispensaries instead of just learning to roll?
Hot water bill, really?
Oh, and that our Terex beanie isn't worth your last paycheck.
You even got your Uncle Walter a Bob Ross Funko Pop for his 45th birthday party, a party that you had to ask to get invited to, and you had to go to f***ing Burnaby for that shit.
Plus, we know the price of eggs and your organic produce.
Want to know a better way to spend your money? Donate to the CITR Intersectionality Collective.
You can donate by going to www.citr.ca/donate. That's www.citr.ca/donate. And don't forget to select the Intersectionality Collective. It's either that or keep lighting your f***ing money on fire.
All right. Okay. So our final in for 2023 is queer politics. So this comes, okay. So basically this is like fighting for like an actual like revolution of like gender and sexuality, and one that's not like based around like definitions and terminology and boxes, like what I was talking about earlier for my out. That's actually about like true liberation and freedom. Okay, so this basically comes from the article written by Kathy Cohen, and it's Punks, Bulldaggers, and Welfare Queens, The Radical Potential of Queer Politics. So I read this paper in my second year of university, and I read it basically three times a year after that. I recommend everyone read this paper. I am not at all saying it's perfect, but it is, I think it's super important. So basically, in this article, Cohen is arguing for looking beyond like the homogeneity of like homosexuality and within like the queer community. So she writes, quote, "I envision a politics where one's relation to power and not some homogenized identity is privileged in determining one's political comrades," end quote. So this basically just means that like, you know, what I was talking about earlier, like having this like badge, this term that like lets you in to the club, getting rid of that, because that's not going to get us anywhere, right? If we don't support one another to go beyond this like single axis of oppression, then we don't actually like fight against the people that are truly causing us harm. Okay, so I'm sorry, that was probably not super academic, but somewhat. So yeah, I kind of just wanted to talk a little bit about how, like, I mentioned this earlier jokingly that like all of my friends are straight. But this is truly because like when I look for friends, I'm not looking for like a term that they use or like the ways in which they identify, even with their gender or their sexuality. Obviously, I think it draws people in because like you typically find a correlation between people's openness and willing to look at their own identity and then accepting other people's identity. But that doesn't mean it's like, you know, a straight line, right? It's much more messy than that. So yeah, I think in 2023, we should have an actual true queer politics. And this is me basically yelling through the airwaves to all of you young white gay people, queer people, however you identify, please read about the history of this community and please understand what it is that this, you know, view of being queer means. And yeah, I think that will just go beyond. And if we can recognize the ways in which, you know, your sexuality interacts with gender and patriarchy and racism and classism and colonialism. Yeah, because at the end of the day, our fight is not against one person on the internet who deemed the, you know, or who we deem to use the word lesbian wrong. It's about the people in power that prohibit us from having true freedom.
Yeah, one thing I want to say, I feel like there's been this big loss in the queer community of talking to community elders. And really, as much as I want, it's definitely very important to learn about queer history through academia and specific writings and learn history that way. But I would also say, just on a more interpersonal level, speaking to community elders and people who have been around and who have been through more lived experience than, you know, is tangibly possible in my 18 years has been very instrumental in my life. And I think that it's something that more people need to be doing, and it needs to be prioritized. And so I hope that there's a resurgence of that. And yeah, queer politics.
Yeah. And I think, like, also, I mean, I've literally probably just said this, but I think also, like, going beyond this, like, idea of, like, a queer community and, like, who is part of it and who can, like, gain access. Is like, to me, that's like actually what being queer is. You know, it's not like, if you read about the history of queer theory, it's very different than the ways in which the term is used on the internet now, which I'm not going to like take a stance either way. I don't think I have the right to dictate that language use. But yeah, this really, to me, this leads in so well to what Serena was talking about, like the need for reading like intersectional literature, because that's really important. I think that's the main way that I've learned about this, and like understanding, like reading this paper, and, you know, reading the books that Serena was talking about. I think that is, you know, a way in which that we gain this queer politics and we actually enact it to, you know, have our nice little revolution anyways.
Yeah, Randy, just going off of that, like, I think the biggest, okay, I don't want to say the biggest issue, actually, I don't feel confident in my expertise for that, but I think an issue with queer representation and, like, if you're saying to, like, inspire a movement and, like, why hasn't there been, you know, a revolution by now, I think it's a representation issue, and I think it's a accessibility to information issue, but the thing is, that information still does exist. Like, it's not hidden, or no, it is hidden, but it's not gone. Like, it exists, it's difficult to get access to, and there are structural reasons to that. It's not by accident. Their system was designed in certain ways to bury people and to hide certain voices, but there is information out there, and if you look, you can find it. It's just, I think that maybe another in for 2023 is helping people gain access to information that maybe us as like liberal arts students at UBC would be able to read papers like the one that you mentioned, whereas, you know, somebody else would not even have the chance to hear about this. So maybe another in is just kind of that access to information regarding a revolution of queer politics.
All right. So that brings us to the end of our formal episode for Fun Drive 2023. And I hope to all of you listening, you enjoy the rest of Fun Drive, which is almost over when you're hearing this. But please donate, please support us. As you can tell, we have a lot of fun on this show. Yeah, and thank you so much for listening and your support.
Thanks for listening to Intersections by CITR's Intersectionality Collective on 101.9 FM. We would love to be reached by email at intersectionalitycollective@citr.ca or on Instagram at intersectionality_CITR. Send us your comments, feedback, and episode ideas. You can also find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program, and our theme song is provided by Young and Sexy. Tune in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., 2 weeks from now, for the next episode.